Welcome to Breaking Down Bits, a conversation about great comedy bits with the comedians who wrote and performed them.
Hey, welcome to Breaking Down Bits. I'm Brian Gendron.
What's up? I am Drew Jordan, and we are excited. Man, it's been season two has been exciting. Gotta say, thanks for hanging in here with us. Thanks for fighting through this weird pandemic and still trying to get better as a comedian. You know, it's not an easy time to do it, but hopefully these interviews and this time that we spend together and maybe hopping in the open mic on Tuesdays has been beneficial for you. I know it's been beneficial for me. It keeps something fun in my head all the time when it comes to writing. I need those new ideas. I need to see those new angles. It's been beneficial for me and hopefully for you guys too.
Absolutely. Yes. Thanks for joining us for all the episodes. These are meant to be timeless capsules for any comic at any level to go back or just comedy fans to listen to and learn about how these jokes are created, how to perform stand-up comedy and the business of stand-up comedy. And I can tell you, I am absolutely a benefactor of this, Drew. I have been pumping out material faster than I ever have. And it's undoubtedly because of the work that we're putting in here and what we're learning from these great comics. So talking about that, Drew, let's get into callbacks. What did we learn from Joyelle?
I mean, she was such a fun interview. We had a blast with her. And if you saw the teaser that we shared on social media, I think that was one of the highlights of the interview was just a reminder that sometimes it's not all about the words. Sometimes it really is about the rhythms and the cadences and the way that you say things. And I think sometimes, I know personally, I can get really in the weeds of what the joke is about and the words of the joke, and then sometimes fall flat when it comes to the performance and the way that you say them. And it's really a package deal. You really have to keep both in mind at all times. And she really nails that point home in the interview, especially in that one time we had a lot of fun with her. But yeah, that's something that is just a good reminder for everyone. It's not just what you say. It's also how you say it. They go together. You got to have both.
Absolutely. And the one thing that really stuck out to me, her and I both related around the fact that we're storytellers. And one of the places I saw Joyelle and Nicole Johnson was on True TV. Cypher Sounds has a show. Do you remember what it's called?
I can't remember.
Laugh Tracks. And what they do is they act out their bits. And she talked about the idea that she watched them act this out. And she's like, oh, you know, I didn't think about that. That would be how it played out. So I wanted to bring up two things about that. One is what she said, which is, you know, comedy is truth meets exaggeration, right? So how exaggerated can your jokes be? Drew, you used a great word, cinematic. How cinematic can your jokes be? I used the word vivid. These are all great thoughts, especially for storytellers. Now, call to action for comics, and this includes you and I in the room. We are struggling now where mics are few and far between showcases. We're not getting booked as much because of the pandemic. Here's what we can do. Why cannot we do our own laugh tracks, right? Why can we not take our own established bits and put them out and work with our friends who are comics, who are actors, and put them out on YouTube just to get your material to go a little bit further and helping promote and get your comedy out to the world? Why not, Drew?
Yeah, you got to take advantage of this. Like, I am a huge fan of YouTube. I'm knee deep editing a new YouTube series right now. I love the medium of sharing jokes and sharing your life and your point of view through video. So if you're not doing it, you're really missing the boat right now. You got to find some way. I'll shout out. We have a local comic named Zod, and he has just a beautiful new thing where he's just creating some interesting graphics and the audio of his stand-up performance. And he is repurposing these great jokes that did well on stage and creating digital content with them. It's great. We should all be doing that. It's a wonderful way to package and share those jokes in a visual medium. You don't have to act it out totally. Maybe you just create a graphic. It's just like, be creative. Don't just be a stand-up comic. You have to be more in 2020.
Yeah, we've talked about that with a lot of our guests. So get back there and listen to Joyelle Nicole Johnson. Listen to all of our other shows. The conduit to get everything that we put out is breakingdownbits.com. We also regularly run Breaking Down Bits open mics, which is an online comedy open mic. Great. Honestly, I think I've talked about this. This is something I'll continue probably post pandemic, a great place to workshop new jokes in a safe environment. So if you'd like to participate in that, please email us at breakingdownbits@gmail.com. Hell, I'm going to run one next week. I commit to it. We try to do them Tuesday nights. So I'm going to do one this coming Tuesday. Hopefully Drew, you're in too. We take seven comics. We do it for an hour. It's a lot of fun. Last call out, you mentioned Zod Devji. I'll post one of his videos in our social media. That's not us. Our social media is breaking down at breaking down bits. Except for Twitter, it's at breaking down bit, but breaking down bits where you can get us on Instagram, Facebook, and we find stuff that we post, including clips and bits and fun stuff that we find. So let's go ahead, Drew, at this point, and bring in our guest. Very excited to talk to this young man coming in from New York. Let's do a quick intro.
Jay Jordan is a New York-based comedian, writer, and actor. You've seen him on The Tonight Show, Comedy Central, and The Late Show. He's been featured on MTV News' Need to Know and High Maintenance on HBO. His debut album, Jay Jordan, Y'all, debuted number one on iTunes. Jay was selected as one of the Just for Laughs New Faces 2019, and Vulture named him one of the comedians you should and will know in 2020.
Jay Jordan, y'all.
What's up? Hey, I'm so happy whenever Southern people say the album because it sounds right. I titled it that way so that New Yorkers and Northerners would have to be like, Jay Jordan, y'all. I'm like, no, you didn't get it. You didn't get it. You didn't do it right. Try it again.
I am from deep East Texas, and those words come so natural to my heart. It's just
roll out like K-Ro corn syrup. What's up?
I'm ready for it.
let me quickly put the album cover over here to, I guess Jay's right. Is that's you as a child, I imagine?
That is me as a child. That's a photo from my home. My mom had to send me the actual picture, and then I scanned it and I sent it to Comedy Dynamics. It was gonna be like an homage. A lot of rappers do this for their first albums, and a lot of comedians too, because the skill sets kind of cross over. You'd be like, okay, for the first album, baby picture of me. I think the most famous one is like Ready to Die, like the Biggie one. But like, you're like, if you have a fun, cute baby picture and you don't necessarily know what you want to do for an album and you don't want to spend money on album artwork, like that's the way to go.
We're already learning, Drew.
Noted. Yeah,
absolutely. And that's a baby picture taken in Mississippi. You grew up in Mississippi?
Grew up in Mississippi, born and raised, didn't leave Mississippi permanently until I was in my late 20s.
Okay.
Well, I went Mississippi, Alabama, and then left the South. But it was like, I was there. I never left.
But you started doing comedy in Mississippi?
The first time I ever did anything akin to stand-up comedy was in Mississippi. In high school, I wrote sketches. It was like the first time I was ever given the opportunity to write sketches. And then in college, because of my theater degree, and because I had a really, really cool professor by the name of Rory Ledbetter, we had a stand-up section. So we had a section in my theater degree where we studied stand-up for a couple of weeks, and he knew I really liked it. I was so obsessed with stand-up and with sketch and with just like comedy as theater that like a lot of times the notes I'd be given in my theater class would be like, well, Jay, maybe don't always go for the laugh. And I was like, what is this, a funeral? And they're like, yeah, it is. This is a funeral scene. Someone's dead.
Also, Ledbetter, the most Mississippi name I've ever heard.
Oh my God. Yeah. Shout out Rory. He was a professor at Ole Miss, and he still is. He's very good. He taught me a lot of like basic steps from the formulaic comedic standpoint to like even the idea of like having a stand-up persona that is in line or in the historical tradition of these people. Like, this is an example of this stand-up persona. It's when I realized I was gonna be observational and autobiographical in comedy, and then part of that for me was like, okay, well, what's that mean as a Southerner, as a Black person, as a queer person? Where do all those things like line up? So that's the first time I ever did stand up. And I had two opportunities to do like kind of stand up shows in Oxford, Mississippi at Ole Miss. And then in Alabama, because I had like another badass kind of teacher, Seth Panich, who was from LA, and he loved stand up. We had a stand up section, but this time in that stand up section of my master's degree, we had to study a stand up and then we had to transcribe their set. I chose the prior set where he was talking as the African animals. He was like the cheetah. He's like, like where he was like making the animals blacker. And I had to write it down, do it like as a monologue for the class. And then my final project for Allison Hetzel, another one of my instructors, she was like, Jay, what do you want to do? I was like, I want to have the basis for a one-man show. And so I did it. I studied, I like wrote down a bunch of autobiographical stuff because it was the first time I was going to address some stuff in that format. And so I did it, and it was 2015. And she was like, Jay, I loved it, but it wasn't balanced. And I was like, oh, you're right. She's like, it was just a really good stand-up set. And I was like, whoops. And so that's when I was like doing stand up, and I had done stand up kind of like as a dare. I wrote a lot of the parodies and a lot of the sketches and a lot of the roast jokes for my undergrad stuff and for my grad school stuff. I wrote parody songs. I wrote parody raps. And so from a brand standpoint, I was like, okay. And so I moved to New York in 2015, and I got signed with a theatrical agent. And one thing that stand-ups have that actors don't is autonomy. Stand-ups can say, I'm going to do a mic. I'm going to do this mic so I can do my 5 minutes, and then I'm going to go home. Actors don't always get to say, I'm going to go do this monologue in front of people. You have to pay for a class, or you have to like be in a workshop, or you have to sign up for something. So there's an ability to self-generate and self-create and promote and like build community with people as a stand-up that you don't have as an actor, specifically in New York as a stage actor who doesn't sing. So that's the thing I loved when I discovered it. So I went to freemics.com like everybody else, went to mics, and then I had one really cool opportunity, a bar that has closed down now, but the first time I ever felt like I really like got to do good stand-up, it was at a gay bar in Hell's Kitchen called Vodka Soda Bottoms Up. My friend was hosting a show there that was a weekly show, and he like said something on Twitter. He's like, I'm looking for comedians. And I was like, I'll do it. He's like, you do comedy? And I was like, yeah. And I did it. And it's a set that's like, okay. But I was so happy that like I got to do like a 15-minute set there that I was like, okay, this is good. And then I just kept refining. I was insatiable. I like, one time he asked me to do it, and I was like, yeah, but I want to do I want to either do more time, or I want to do like a panel section with you where we riff on current events. And like, you know how like when you like stand up, you start to become obsessed. It's scary. It's all you can think about. So I'm being a personal trainer at two gyms while doing this. And I have like an agent that does not believe in me because they're a theatrical agency. So they don't like any of this. They're just like, I guess, but you need going. So nothing was going the way I wanted it to on that end. But with stand-up, I was having a lot of fun. So I just kept doing it.
Wow. Well, it sounds like you had like the right start, right? Like, you kind of were in this from the start. You were interested in creating parody and comedy and stuff as a very young person before you even did stand up. You were creating all the time.
Yeah, I went to a performing arts school when I was 12. The first time I knew I wanted to like do something funny for other people, I was like 11, and The Nutty Professor came out. I watched it with my family. I came back to school the next day and like there's like the scene, the clumps scene at the table, and I did part of that scene for my friends, and I was like, oh, this is fun. And so the next, that would have been the spring, I think. So then my mom asked me, she was like, what do you want to do next year? I was going from fifth grade to sixth grade, and I was like, I want to audition for theater. And she's like, okay. And so I auditioned and I got in, and it was fun.
So you know what's interesting? Drew and I, Drew, you went to college, right?
I went to college.
Yeah, I'm shocked, but no.
I went to Ole Miss in Alabama. That's whenever people, because people up here, they'll be like, oh, I went to college. They'll be talking about Dartmouth or fucking Penn or like Princeton. I'll be like, no. I went to a minor league football school with some college classes attached to it that were optional.
That's right. But what I was going to say was, you're the first person on the show and really that I've talked to in comedy that isn't like, you know, I went to college and now I'm doing comedy. You're like, I went to school. I got graded on stand-up projects. I wish I knew about that. I would have went to Ole Miss, man. but that's terrific, because a lot of us are like, our parents are really like this thing where like our parents would be disappointed because amounting to what we set out to be. You're on the path, man. And so
you're actually using your college degree in 2020. Yeah. How?
Yeah.
Oh, I think it helped me look at stand up in a way that was like easy to categorize. I was like, okay, this is what I want out of stand up. This is why I want this joke to work. If you're doing true stand up, a lot of it, and when it comes back, people will, it's going to pendulum swing. You have to do a lot of the material repeatedly. You love a joke because you wrote it, but you also know this joke works. And how do you know it works? Because the crowd says that joke works, and they say it through laughs. And the repeated action of that is acting. Because the first thing a lot of people learn when they start doing stand-up is they like they don't know how to articulate it in a way that's not negative. They go, wait a second, it's fake. This is fake. This is all fake. You said that joke last week, and you're like, yeah, I'm going to say it again next week too.
Well, one thing I'd like to get into when we like to talk on the industry side of things is your first break. So what, you know, you made this move to New York. Why the move? And when did you decide to make that move? And what really got you from being a local comedian to kind of on the stage of this nationwide platform that you have today?
Okay. Thank you, Drew. So I learned how to do comedy in a very hard place to do comedy. It's an easy place to get started in comedy. It's a hard, the skill level starts to like creep up on you very fast. And so what I had is I had that one man show that was close to 30 minutes. So I had 30 minutes of material that I could just like refine. And it was like, you boil that down, it's like greens. Like then it's 10 minutes. You know, when you put spinach in a pot, it's like that. You go, wow, man, it's a whole bag. Wait a second. It's not a whole bag. It's just like that. So I had that. I also had a very unique POV, and I knew who I was. I was in my late 20s. And the biggest break for me is two things happened. I was going to a mic, and they said, oh, sign up for this Bringer show. You're doing really well at this mic. We like your stuff. You definitely are very, very comfortable on stage. And I was like, it's because I've been doing this since I was 12. They said, you should do this Bringer show. And I was so lucky because people had seen my Facebook post and my tweets and like two articles in New Yorker and one article in McSweeney's. And they're like, oh, Jay's funny. And so I had enough people that went to this show at Broadway Comedy Club that I was able to perform, because under a certain amount, they would have put you at the end and not given you your tape. So I performed really well. I got a residency from that. And that's in that same like 2 month period. I went to another mic with a friend of mine. They were like, oh, come to this mic. I kept going to the mic. I really liked it. It was the Comedy Mob mic at the Grizzly Pear. And then they said, we're going to do a competition, Jay. And it's only for people who are like kind of newer. Do you want to do it? And I was like, sure. And I won that one. And the person who became my agent saw me win that. put me on two other shows. I was like, you should do these two showcases. One of them was up in the Bronx. They did, like, I was so worried it wasn't going to go well because I was like, man, I don't know how, okay, I don't know what's going to happen. And it went really well. And they put me, they saw me on another show at, I want to say New York Comedy Club randomly. And they were like, oh, I think if I get this promotion, I'm going to push to sign you. And I was like, as what? And they're like, as a comedian, do you want me to push to sign you? Do you have enough material? I was like, yeah, because I won that competition in November. And the next summer, part of the deal was like, you have to have you do an hour for this other club. And I was like, I got an hour. And I had it, but I also like was mapping it out. I have like this picture of me and my friend Mike Lasher. We rented a WeWork space, got a whiteboard, and like storyboarding my hour. So I always approached it kind of theatrically and kind of academically. I was always like, okay, I can do this. So those were the two big breaks. And because of those breaks, everything else I feel happened. Like everything else after those two, because those two places where people saw me the most and where I got some of the best tapes that I submitted to NACA and to Stand Up NBC, and NACA and Stand Up NBC set me up for the other things that happened.
Very awesome. I mean, it sounds like it's, you know, one thing that always comes up is like everybody who ends up being at least majority we've interviewed has won some sort of local competition. They're always these guys who guys and girls.
Hey, but Drew, also here's like a trick. They're like a lot of competition. sometimes someone could be like, they're a winner of this festival. And you'd be like, when was that festival? They'll be like, it just happened. You'd be like, when? They'd be like, this afternoon.
Okay, so now I'm going to start my own festival competition.
Exactly.
I'm the winner in my credits.
That's the perfect thing to do. I always think that like, so those competitions help like also sharpen your blade because you have to know. I was very lucky that I always knew what I wanted my closers to be. The first time I hear a closer or something that could potentially become a closer, because I'm working on like three new ones that have the energy for like the new stuff I'm working on, I'm always like, okay. I just like, I take the information I got from the mic or from the crowd that first heard it, and I go, oh, okay. 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 That one's moving further back in the lineup now.
Gotcha.
I know exactly what you're talking about when finding closers. I find finding closers is easier than finding openers. Do you?
Oh, yeah. Finding closers is so much more fun and rewarding too, because it's the release. The opening has to be good enough that they listen, but also you can't blow your wad. It's like an opening salvo. It has to be aggressive. It's like, okay, you know, like sometimes the first play you call on like Madden and people are like, what was that? You're like, I was trying something new, y'all. I know how to play this game. You're like, okay, you say so. All right. You can't really do a play action if you haven't established the run, Jay. I don't know what.
Yeah, fake punts. What are you?
That one.
First down. Yeah.
I'm terrible at Madden. Gosh, my roommate was a football coach, and he would just route me every day in college. You're like, Drew, want to play Madden? Fine.
Yeah, but we spent a lot more on writing on the second half. But I love what you're saying about the contest. I myself have won a contest, but it's funny and kind of like what you're saying. There was like, if you had done pro comedy, you couldn't enter. So it's like all new people, and I'm like,
yeah.
And then I'm competitive, super competitive.
Good.
And so I'm gonna put in the work, which is really the key, right? Not just being competitive, that's not enough. But then crashing mics as many as you can get to for the weeks leading up to it.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And he's going in with the mentality like, I'm going to win this, or I'm not going to win it. And everybody's going to say I should have won it. Those are the two outcomes.
Brian, that is the energy. Oh my God. So there was one competition. I did a showcase. It was supposed to be like a new talent showcase. And the person who won, they had done Letterman. And I was like, that's not what? I was like, that's not allowed.
That's crazy.
So it was definitely one of those situations where it's like, okay, you don't win, but you want everyone there to be like, wait a second, who was that? I like the idea of comedy autonomy and comedy anonymity. Autonomy is you saying, I'm going to go do this by myself. I don't need someone else. I'm the product. I'm the writer, the editor, the director, and the producer of this. Let me go do it. The second, that's autonomy. Comedy anonymity is you walking in somewhere and people going, I don't know who this dude is. I don't know this dude. I don't know anyone. And then when you walk out, they go, oh, I love that dude. Who's that dude I didn't know? You want the anonymity because the stakes are lower. No one expects it. And you can almost sucker punch people. It's when people go, Jesus, who is this?
Jake, I love that. A comedy and an enemy, Drew, is what we strive for because we are absolute nobodies. And so, that's all we got, man. That's all we got.
Man, hold on. I mean, y'all, listen, it's such a relative term because as you move up the ladder, you still realize that. Like, you go from being like the person who everyone knows at this club in New York, you literally go two doors down, and I'm like, someone was like, you want to do the show at the Cellar real quick? And I was like, yeah. I was just like, well, I was in the Village and I saw people I knew. And then I saw a comic I knew and he was about to do a show. He's like, I'm pretty sure one person is going to drop out and be like, do you want to be on the show? And I was like, yeah. And so like performing at the Cellar, to me, that's my Madison Square Garden because that's it. That's the Acme. That's the Mecca. That's the ceiling. For where you can perform is this. It's the store in LA and then it's the Cellar in New York. And so I was like, yeah, but don't nobody know me at the Cellar? They know me a little bit more now because of a few things, but like I'm not past at the Cellar either. Like there's still so many steps that everyone has to take.
Yeah, no, we live that every day. It is nice. Sometimes I think about that when it comes to when I watch someone special. I'm like, okay. If they're a well-known comic, in my head, you kind of go, you got to remember, this room is packed full of people who know this comedian, who understand their sensibility, their personality, and you can't compare yourself in a bar show with what's happening in that room. Like, these are different worlds. Okay? This is know you that and you know yeah comedy tonight.
Like, Drew, you also don't get the option to be like, okay, let's get that second one for pickup at a bar show on these specials. Because on the Comedy Central 30 minute special, you do like 45 to 50 and they go,
yeah,
I think you do like usually 40 and then go.
Get it down. Yeah. That's a luxury one day that I hope we all get.
Oh, hell yeah.
Until then, it's just slugging through it and trying to bring the A game and create as much funny as you have to create attention.
Like,
you have to draw the attention in first before you can even get the funny going at these bar shows.
But that's such a good skill. And Southern comedians have an advantage because our go-to is charm, accessibility, affability, being affable. Up here, people are like, I don't give a fuck if you don't want to be here. And in Houston, people, like, that's, first of all, more people in the South have guns. So if you start shit at a show, okay. Okay. People fight. Like, people saw that clip from a comic getting beat up in Huntsville. They're like, oh, do they always fight? I was like, if you talking shit, it might happen. Why are you surprised?
That's true, though. I think there is I always joke. So I grew up in a super Christian household in the South. And I say, that's why I'm not great at crowd work. I can't just be mean to people. I can't do it. It's not in my DNA. I have a really hard time being like, that shirt looks... Oh, pretty great, man.
We had Sarah Tiana on here talking about roast comedy, and Drew and I did a roast with each other, and he was toast. He just, it's not. And I live in Houston.
Okay.
Yeah, no. and I live in Houston now, but I'm from the Northeast, and like Jay, I get it, man. It's hard, especially in New York. My wife's from New York. I get it.
Well, also like roast comedy, there's like this little corner of like roast comedy, like Comedy Fight Club, and like when roast comedy got super popular on Comedy Central, and then on True TV a little bit too. So like when you roast someone or roast something, that skill set is almost such a specialized skill set. You're playing a different version of the game.
Yeah.
Because you want to like needle it and like fix it. Whereas like with your set, you don't always need to be there. So it's like it's a very cool specialized skill, but then you have to be able to flip that switch on and off in your brain.
I like being roasted. It's a great way to farm new material. Because yep. you have the luxury of knowing who you are early on, which I was, you know, when you said that, when you're like, I'm going to do observational, I'm like, what? How did you get to start like that? Most of us have to figure out who the hell we are.
Oh.
And we don't learn it until we get on stage and we kind of like, oh, that's who I am. But when you're roasting, yeah. They're like, this is exactly who you are. And this is why it's funny. So it's great.
we should probably turn the corner and start talking about a little writing.
Oh, sweet.
We like to ask the really broad, open-ended question. So answer however you feel, but how does Jay Jordan write comedy?
Oh, this is how I do it. I talk to myself a lot. I mumble in my house all the time, in the shower. My boyfriend usually knows that's how I'm home, is if I'm like talking, if I'm like repeating a bit. In the shower, I'll go like full volume. But if I'm like here, I'll be like this. Okay. If it comes to me, and then I try to put it down either in my phone. And then if it's in a notebook, then that means I'm like trying to look at sequencing or something. But if I can put like something I write down in my phone, like that's like me saying, okay, this can work. And so like I'll have my notes app and I'll write stuff down. Some things have come from tweets and they ended up being in my brain first. I tweeted them, they did well, and then I tried them on stage to even see. Like it happened, I did a Halloween show and it was right before the election. I had a tweet that went really well. I was like, undecided voters? And the tweet was, if you're an undecided voter right now, that just means you're a white person who wants to be on TV. Because there's no such thing as right now. And so like I said on stage and went really well. But my idea for writing on Twitter is a good place for premises and for beginnings, but then you have to figure out what the exclamation point and or period of that joke is going to be and if you're going to tag it. So I also write from a very like, how am I getting to this part? So a lot of the stuff on my album I loved because there's a joke that I did on Fallon where I talk about like a dude left the show. I was saying some of my jokes about being bi and the guy got up and left. And like in my head, I was like, I didn't mess with him because I didn't want to be about him. It's about me. And I was like, oh man, how do I make this a joke? And it ended up being one of my favorite jokes ever because I like just remembered that, held on to it. And I was like, how do I explain this? Like this guy left. What's funny about him leaving? He's leaving because like there's a guy telling queer jokes on stage. But he's like, oh, I didn't know there's gonna be a gay guy here. And he left. And in my head, I'm thinking, sir, what are you doing? This is New York City. There are definitely more outside. And so that ended up making it on TV. But then what made it on the album was the tag version of that, where I can like kind of like Brian said, be more of a storyteller and play with the cinematic, exaggerated version of that. So then I go, like the complaint is like, complaining about gay guys in New York, that's like going to the beach and saying, I love the water, but why didn't anyone tell me about all this damn sand? Sand is what makes the beach. What are you talking about?
That's good.
I write kind of like, I go, something I observe, internalize, and then through my filter, that's how I get to it. And my filter is going to be, I'm Southern, I'm a millennial, I'm Black, I'm bisexual, I'm left-handed. You know, like, though, then those things color what comes out the other end of it.
And Drew, before we move on to the next piece, the one thing I've been finding lately is I'm getting writing longer sets. So I've probably got 30 to your point that you boil it down and bring it to New York. It's like five, but
I'll probably make 15, but yeah,
my 30. But like what's happening is jokes are compounding and I'm having these experiences in show that I can now talk about as jokes, which is what you just talked about. You know, the guy's got the same tattoo in the crowd and we had an exchange. This girl called my joke. You know, she said it was offensive and then we had an interaction. Those all become new jokes, and
that's
over time you have a collection of those which strengthens and lengthens
it, and it's like it's the comedy god's gift, because this is what happens. You in that moment, if you aren't a storyteller comedian, if you're a one-liner comedian and you love these one-liners, you've had an interaction about one of your one-liners, so then you get to pivot and the audience gets to hear a different tactic from you based on whatever your comedic kind of like, whichever way you lean as a comedian, whatever you traditionally do, or whatever your preference is, you get to downshift and go into something else. Like if you don't do act outs, like you get to have an act out. If you don't tell stories, you get to tell a joke and then the crowd likes that joke and you go, I'm so glad you guys like that joke because
yeah.
Now here's a story about that joke.
People, I feel like as an audience member, I like that stuff. I feel like I'm getting an inside behind the scenes look at this person's life and I'm getting to know them better through that experience. Like
you're a joke nerd. You're a joke nerd now. That's the difference. You know?
I'm like, tell me more.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's fun.
The next question we kind of get into is, how do you prepare for a set? Let's say you have something coming up in the future. Are you writing set lists? What are you doing to prepare? If you kind of know what that audience might be. And then what are you doing those moments before you step on stage?
Oh, so if I get I got a big gig. First thing I think is like time. How long is it? If it's TV, if it's like a late night set, now that I know from the experience of Fallon, like you need to write for 4:30, right? If it's 5 minutes, you need to write for 4:30. Mm-hmm. Because if the stuff is that good, then you're going to be around 4:50 and some change if you just give it for 4:30 or even like 4:20. And then what are you doing it for? If you want to get like your best, if you want to get a good tape out of it, then I say swing for the fences, fastballs all the time. If it's an opportunity where you can get something out of it, fast balls. And so that means the mics you do before that are for repetition, not for creation. And so then you're saying, I know how this works. I'm wrapping my brain around these words and making this like perfect. It's rehearsal. If it's longer, then you go, what story do I want to tell? How do I want to end and begin this? Like, where do I want to go? Like with that Comedy Central set, when they tell you it's, you can do like 10 minutes, you're like, okay, so like, what do people, where does I want to go point by point? Like, how do I really want to like give them for 10 minutes? And has anything happened recently that is new enough and interesting enough that if I put it in my set, people will be like, what? Whoa, you talking about this? When did you write this? How can I figure out something super new to put in if it's like a longer set? So then I write my set list out, probably using keywords instead of full sentences, and I run that on whatever shows. That's when I call in favors. I only usually call in favors. I try not to, but like anytime I get an opportunity to do something big, I'll be like, can I run this set this week? Can I do this twice? If a club has four shows on a Saturday, I'd be like, can I do this twice, 5 minutes on like the 8 o'clock show and 10 o'clock show? And people usually be like, oh yeah, you can do it. Once you tell them what it's for, like you got to tell people what it's for because they want to feel like they're in on the secret. Yeah. So if you're like, okay, so I have to run this. And they're like, for what? And then you're like, I can't. Even if you go, I can't say, they go, oh, okay. And so then they let you. And then they find out it wasn't anything important. They get mad. or that you, if you lost. So I write my set down in my phone as keywords and I run that. And so that's how I prepare for like that kind of set. Everything's changed recently because now when I was preparing for outside sets, I like tried to always, like, I looked at the weather. I would also like see like what I wanted to talk about. I would kind of do a sandwich set, and Gaster Alamonte and Jess Solomon, who are comedians in New York, they have this really cool show called Sandwich, and it's, you do old stuff, then in the middle, you do your newer stuff, and then at the end, you close strong with your old stuff. And that's why it's called a sandwich set. And I think it's one of the smartest ways to do comedy, because the audience goes, that the audience hears your good stuff at the beginning, they like you. Then if the middle stuff isn't great, that's okay. It's not baked all the way. It's like a chocolate chip cookie. It's kind of gooey. What you, okay, salmonella's fun, chill out. And then you close strong at the end. So it's like a fun way to experiment and create. So that's what I do on set, on shows. And then sometimes a high stakes show, I won't experiment. Lower stakes shows to me can be like, you can almost treat them like a highly curated mic. Like you can be like, I'm glad you guys like that really good stuff. Now here is some newer stuff.
And then he kind of slipped it in there, but just moments before you get on stage, you have any rituals or anything you're doing?
Oh yeah. I get up and move. I walk around a lot. I walk around, I move. If I have a physical action that I'm going to do on stage, I'll do that. This is like kind of actory training stuff. I will do that, that movement and or that motion to make sure I'm doing it right. Like I had a joke recently that I'm very happy with that. It has like a kick out. Well, and part of the reason the kick came along is because people were like, oh man, I don't like Zoom shows. And I was like, were you kicking a lot? Why don't you like Zoom shows? Were you a big lower body comedian? What was happening, dog?
Is the Starbucks kick that we're going to see?
Yeah. No, so it wasn't the leg up. It was the, there's a newer joke where I was like, it's hard to be wealthy now. Like being rich is different. Like if you're wealthy, that is generations of money that's accrued. You can't be wealthy unless your great grandfather was like Native Americans. Nope. And I do like, I do like a field goal kick. And the field, and he's punting a baby is what I want people to know. But it's like, that's an actionable thing that I want to be ready for that on stage when before I do it. So that's, I'll do that action and I'll listen to music. Yeah. Stretch out. I'll listen to music. I try to listen to something fun. People always ask me, what my interest music should be. It's always, I always say Mo Money, Mo Problems. Mo Money, Mo Problems is a song. If I hear it in a club, I get happy. So if I hear it on stage, I get happy. So that's it.
So if anybody asks what Jay's doing before show, he is listening to Biggie and air punting babies.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's put it on the shirt.
We're learning. Yeah, that's right. That's a shirt, man. Okay, we're going to play the clip. This is that Comedy Central piece. Anything specific about that day that you wanted to call out?
Yes. So this was a testament to my patience. So there were two shows that night. It was at, I want to say Rough Trade in Brooklyn. They had brought in another audience. There was a show before that one with comedians. So they filmed all this in one night. And I was like fourth. I had a good spot on the lineup because I wasn't first. I was like fourth. And I just got in from Chicago. I did Zany's the day before. And I just got in from Chicago that day. And it was kind of like one of those things where you like run around all the time. And I felt really good because I was like wearing that cheetah print shirt. And so I was excited. It was very exciting.
You're feeling yourself. All right, let's play the clip. Yeah.
Something recently happened to me that I feel like we all can relate to. I'll go ahead and say it. My boyfriend wants to adopt a pet raccoon. Yeah. I like telling people that early on in my sets because it lets them know three things about me. Number one, I am queer. Number two, in a relationship. Number three, it's interracial. We don't do that. Just one of my rules as a black person, you cannot adopt a pet that at any point in time could also be used as a racial slur against you. It's why I can't get a raccoon. It's why I can't get a monkey. It's why white people should stop getting labradoodles. Oh, y'all didn't know we was calling y'all labradoodles. My bad, that's on me. I said queer intentionally and explicitly because that's what I am. To me, queerness is that I'm hungry, but I don't know for what of sexualities. My sexuality is just a salad from McDonald's. It's confusing to some, appealing to others. Either way, I'm loving it. You know what? Maybe I'm bi. Maybe I'm bi because I am attracted to very feminine men, but I'm also attracted to very masculine men. I recently told a guy at coffee that information. I said I identify as bi or queer because that's more honest and reflective of my sexual and romantic journey. But if you were to call me gay, wouldn't get mad. Gay is not a bad word. In fact, sometimes gay is just easier shorthand for straight people to wrap their brains around when they don't want to have to use the terms we come out with every 3 months to categorize, quantify, and qualify sexuality. And he said that is a lot to write on one cup. And I said, you right, my bad, homie. My name is Jay, and you guys, he still got my name wrong. He just wrote gay on the cup. Put that there. I hear from those varying pitches that there are some straight people out there. That's nice. Listen, I like straight people. I do a lot of straight outreach, usually at urinals. Just handing out pamphlets, don't get crazy. Okay, here's a little bit of honesty. I used to be straight, then I got better. Yeah, there's a vaccine for it. Did you know? That's right, vaccines don't cause autism. Vaccines make your kids gay. And by that, I mean they let your child live long enough to figure it out. Thank you, because last week I did that joke for what I can only describe as a very pro-polio crowd, so... Between you and me, I'm just happy that joke still has legs. No, you guys, I'm serious. I did used to be straight. I used to date girls because we've all
made mistakes.
And I like to think of the female body the same way I think of the South, in the sense that I'm from there and I visited. But I don't know if that's where I want to raise my kids. Also, it's not the heat, it's the humidity. Does that? Ah, come on, you guys, that is a perfectly pH balanced joke. That joke is a 7. I could go back, ladies. I could go back. That is a threat. Yeah, it could definitely happen. I could go back to dating girls, but me going back to girls, that's like LeBron James going to the Lakers, in the sense that it would cost a lot of money. I'd probably have to bring some of my boys with me. And at the end of the day, you ain't getting no ring.
Oh, that was
he won. He won. He got the you. Listen, LeBron. I wrote that joke, and there was another tag where I was like, "It's like LeBron James going to the Lakers because he already gone to the Lakers." What I was saying is it would be like how the Lakers got LeBron James. It would cost a lot of money. I'd have to bring some of my boys with me. But there's always going to be a cute, light-skinned guy with green eyes who stops you from getting what you really want. And that was going to be about Steph Curry. But I didn't think it. So what it made me want to do is write a joke about how Donald Trump is going to live a long, healthy life. So then hopefully that one ends up being wrong, too. So it's just like that joke to me was such a fun joke, and it was so kind of like this weird mix of what I like to do, like talk about sports, talk about gay stuff. And so I'm so happy it's still in, because there's so many YouTube comments that are like, well, he got this LeBron James joke wrong. I'm like, yeah, you're right. Good. I'm going to buy a Lakers jersey now.
Such a great set. Just a chunk of that set. Like, I think the first thing, two things jump out to me right off the bat. Now that I know, I don't know how I missed it the first watch through. I totally see the one man show theater aspect of your presentation.
Oh, really. Thank you.
And it's so strong. And I feel like you command the stage so well with everything that you bring. And the word economy, you like squeeze every second of that time is working for you, whether it's a squeezing those tags in or working the silence. Is that something that you think a lot about, or is that naturally just come?
Yeah.
What's going on there?
I like to play with speed. I like to play with like fast, slow, normal. Cause if you ever give me a note, usually the note is, Jay, you can slow down. So then I have to go, there's power in like space and not speaking and like playing without the ball, as it were. That's what they called it whenever you were acting and either you didn't have the line or like you had the camera, but you didn't have the line. And it's like playing without the ball. It's like, can you figure out how to occupy this space and make it still important? Gotcha. And so I always wanted my shows and my sets to be strong, not just when I was talking. So like every now and then, if you have a good enough premise or a good enough tag, you can like I love that applause break because it's one of my favorite jokes. And it's kind of rooted in what you said, Brian. It's the vaccine joke came about from like two different shows where I had a joke where I was like, I used to be straight, then I got better. That's right, there's a vaccine for it. Did you guys know? Vaccines don't cause autism. Vaccines make your kids gay. And that's like that's me making fun of Alex Jones. That's me making fun of anti-vaxxers. That's why I go into the Alex Jones voice on that. And then one time I did it at a show and people didn't like it. And I was like, y'all must be a pro polio crowd. Y'all ain't eating up my vaccine joke. And so then I was able to put that into every set afterwards. And then I was able to add the tag. Like, I think I thought of the tag. And the tag about, I'm just happy that joke still has legs. It came to me one day and I was like, that's done. I'm not touching that ever again. I love it. And so, like, that's one of my favorite sections and a story behind the opener. That opener is only in that set. It's not on my album. It's not anywhere else. I like that opener, but it's so strong that it gives away a lot of other jokes that it only could be used for something like that. And I wanted to save it for Comedy Central. I knew when I chose that opener because I saw what they did the year before with like the Comedy Central featuring sets in Brooklyn. And then I saw the whole summer when they did it in LA. I was like, they're using memes. They're turning some of these jokes into memes. And do you have a joke that's a good enough meme? And I was like, yeah, I have one. I just don't. I didn't put it on the album because it works as an opener that's super strong. And that's it. And it's almost too strong of an opener because it gives away a bunch of stuff about me. And unless I'm doing just like a 10-minute set, it's not worth giving it all away at the top of the hour. So I would never do that joke. I went on tour, I didn't do that joke. I didn't put that joke on my album. I wanted that joke in like shorter sets. And so I was like, oh, I know the joke. And Comedy Central was like, when I gave them the transcript of that set, they were like, we love the raccoon joke. I was like, I know, I'll do it.
you bring up something that we hear quite a bit and something that all comics can benefit from is preparation, understanding what the expectations are of the, you know, how is this going to be used? What is the audience like? What is the room like? Whatever research that you can do can help you as opposed to just go, I'm going to do my thing. I'm going to show up and I'm going to be funny. Well, yeah, but if you want to show up your best, there's some other elements that are going to be in the room, whether it's audience or other things that you can play with. And for you, you knew that Comedy Central was going to turn these into memes and things like that. So that played well into that particular setting. So that's the things we need to be thinking about approaching a set.
Strictly. Oh, yeah. And it was a fun joke to open with, too, because it is such – it's like a silly joke about race that I think is like soft enough that no one gets weird. but it's like still funny. Like, and it's part of it is because like my boyfriend, he really does love raccoons. Like for the, we've been together for a very long time and he's always like, if we ever, I was like, that'll never happen. He's from Huntsville and Huntsville's minor league baseball team. If you guys know anything about minor league baseball teams, they'll have stupid, silly names. Yeah. The minor league baseball team in Huntsville is the Huntsville Trash Pandas and they're raccoons. Like he loves raccoons. He follows raccoon Twitter accounts. One time he started crying because I was like, oh no, what happened? I was like, oh, something happened. I was like, it was like one of those things where I was like, oh no, something really bad happened. And I was like, babe, what's wrong? And he said, it's a picture of a raccoon. And I was like, I can't, man. I was like, I don't, listen, maybe Leviticus made some points. I cannot date men.
I love that you bring up, so I haven't heard anyone else have this problem before. So on a personal note, I have a problem with revealing the punchline to some jokes. Other jokes negate it too early.
And oh, yeah. Up.
And I've always struggled and I have a bunch of jokes. So long story short, I have a bunch of jokes about how I got divorced and my wife kind of became a lesbian and bi afterwards. And I have a lot of jokes about it, but I have to be careful how I reveal.
Yeah.
Because if I reveal too much, it just wipes out three or four of those jokes are just unusable because the audience is like, okay, yeah, now you're just beating a dead horse. Like, why?
Drew, I feel that shot selection or joke selection when it comes to where you put what can make or break a long set and make or break a short set. So you're spot on. And whenever people don't realize that, then they aren't living truthfully and honestly in the moment and responding to, like, the audience will tell you. The audience will be like, oh, it's when you get diminishing returns on a joke mm-hmm. instead of it being like a huge pop. You're like, oh, okay. Oh, okay. So I have to say this.
It's tricky because if I do those jokes at different places, like this will get a pop, but it won't get a pop if I do it after this other one because I've already broken the seal. So I like that. And I like the term shot selection a lot.
Is. I like you got to save it. I saved that joke. If I would have done that joke on TV for another thing, if I do that joke on tour, it just like takes away so many other jokes because I have a joke about like the reveals my boyfriend's race that reveals the fact that I'm like in a queer relationship. And so like, it's not always worth it to go into it first. Cause you think, oh, big pop, it saves it. But it's like, no, it doesn't. Cause I might need this. So I think save it for your Comedy Central set.
Yeah, that's a good idea. so does that mean you stick pretty closely to a set list? Like, a lot of comedians like have the set list and they kind of say, yeah, the first and the last and everything in the middle is kind of wherever it happens. You stick tighter?
I stick very tight to a set list when I get a check. If someone's paying me to do something, I treat it like it's a script. Okay. Like as a comic, you're going to be your own script supervisor. You're going to be the person who says, say this the right way, do it again. Whenever I would coach people, like, so whenever I was a acting coach in grad school. So you got to teach kids how to act. Repetition was one of the things people hated that made them do, but it's the only way I can learn lines. It's like repetition is like, say it again, say it again, say it again. Cause you have to be able to do that joke with the laugh right after and then go into your stuff and not be, you can find joy in your own material, but you need to be the driving force. That's like, y'all thought that was fun. Let's get to this next thing that we're about to do and still have fun and still smile and enjoy the material. But you can't be so surprised or even kind of so self-congratulatory that it derails the energy you've set up.
That's a good point.
There's one joke in here that I like to do because it's a writing exercise. You did the McDonald's. I'm loving it. Yeah. The recognizable tagline for brands and things is sometimes I'll try to reverse engineer that from and come up with jokes. How did that come to be? Do you do that type of writing? Or
I love a joke that is specific and universal. The specificity is my sexuality. The universality is the most recognizable brand in the world. And with like a new enough catchphrase for them that it's like, okay, that's like from now. You're not gonna be like, where's the beef? Cause like that's the 80s. That's winners. But like if you can get away with something that lets people know that you live in the same world as them or that like kind of turns something on its head, then that is always fun. I like analogies. I love analogies as a comedian. I've tweeted, I was like, man, comedians who use analogies and colloquial expressions too much in their sets, that's like going to the well one too many times. Like, I understand it's like there's a fine balance, but as long as it's very specific and true to the story that you're telling as a comedian on stage, I love that. So if like, say if you have a pizza tracker joke, but instead it's like about sex, so like there's so many things that come to your mind. It's like, oh yeah, okay, yeah. I sent the text. I'm getting ready to go home. I'm watching it on my screen. Why is it stopped? Why did it stop? What happened? Like, it's like, I feel like that is also where we are as comedians. Like all of us are millennials. So brands and commercialism is part of our growing up. It's like brands, then like religion, but brands are sort of religion-esque because they're a shared communal experience.
Yeah. That's a really good point. I mean, I've done some religious material. Of course, Drew, raised in by the, you know, the son of a priest, a bachelor. Excuse me. God, I'm struggling to define.
Drew, are you the son of a preacher man?
Yeah, son of a preacher man. Yeah.
I think the Lord was doing something to your mouth right then.
Don't let him get it out. but no, I've struggled doing anything religious related. But of course, if you have anything like you said, bring it up a level. Universally, brands are a part of the human experience more so than maybe as divisive as, you know, what religion are you? So it becomes more universally accepted and relatable.
Well, I was raised like Baptist, like super Baptist. Like there was one point, there was like a year where I was like, man, we go to church too much. Like there was a year because my mom it's just like, and my grandmother was like really involved in the church. My great grandmother was really involved in the church. And it's to the point where it's like, what? Like we went on Sunday, then we went on Monday, then we also went on Thursday. And then sometimes we'd go on Friday. And it wasn't always church. It was like Sunday was church, and then Monday was like this other thing that was like basically just an excuse for like church men to be able to like watch football at the rec center for the church. And I was like, y'all can't watch football at the house, but they have to like pray before, but there's also food.
There you go.
So like when it comes to religion, I have a joke where it's like, I talk about I was on Fallon. And so I invoke religion. I say natural teeth. Yeah, that's right. He did this. The big orthodontist in the sky. It's as if God said, your teeth will be straight, but you won't. And so whenever I talk about God, it's not me saying you should believe this or you should believe this. I go, this guy, he got a sense of humor too. And so that's usually how I spin it.
That's an important point. I noticed that in your material, a lot of people who are, and I apologize if I don't
say it
the right way, but some comedians are very passionate about a thing, whether it be politics, religion, sexuality, and sometimes their comedy can come off as preachy.
Yeah.
Trying to tell you that they want to attack the people who disagree. And it can come off kind of like not fun in the end. And you obviously you're a very passionate person about a lot of things, clearly. But your comedy is so fun and well written that I don't get a vibe like you're mad at everyone who disagrees with you. You're just living your life and finding the fun in things. And I just appreciate that so much because there's some comics I just can't listen to because I'm like, stop, just all you're doing is just attacking people that you disagree with. I don't find that's not my personal.
Well, you know what happens. You know what happens. They get super preachy. They get didactic. And that's because they've started to appreciate you're right more than the ha ha ha.
Yeah.
So like it's a different, like it's still like a dopamine button. And like, sure. So you get some serotonin from someone be like, Drew, you're right. You're right, Drew. Damn, but sure. It's not nearly as fun as making someone who doesn't necessarily agree with you on everything still laugh. There have been so many times where people who are worlds apart from me. Yeah, I mean, like you, one time I did a show and a woman and her husband who are like in their late 50s, probably like maybe even early 60s, came with me after show. And they did that thing that happens sometimes. They're like, listen, I didn't think I was going to like it. But I liked it, and then they laughed, and I was like, "So that means the threesome is still on?" They're like, "Oh, you're very funny." Okay, I was like, "All right,
fans for life now." Yeah,
yeah. And so then after the threesome, what happened was no, but I've had those people. I did a charity event for a lacrosse team that was raising money. And so I tell some of my jokes. I have a lot of sports jokes. I have a joke about how like ESPN is just gossip for straight dudes. Like if you're a sports journalist, that just means, because yeah. Like, every sports journalist eventually is like, now you didn't hear from me, but girl, the trade deadline is coming up and somebody's switching teams. It's like all of that kind of stuff. I have a joke about like the NBA. I have lots of jokes about it. I had some really fun Michael Sam jokes. And so a guy afterwards, he was like, you like actually know sports? I was like, yeah, I went to Ole Miss in Alabama. Like I kind of have to. And he was like, man, it's really funny. So like, is the gay stuff, is that a joke too? I was like, nah, that's like pretty real. I was like, I ain't out here like hooking up with dudes for jokes. That's not
you're a method actor.
Yeah. let's do this, guys. We're gonna get into our last segment, Jay, if that's all right with you.
That's perfect.
Let me roll the creepy clip. It's so creepy. Okay. It's called Last Laugh, and here's how it works. You have one joke you can put on your tombstone to be remembered by. Jay Jordan, what would you put on your tombstone? What joke would you put?
Oh, if I could put a joke on my tombstone, I would probably... Oh, okay. So it's a joke about my mom and my dad that I haven't said yet on stage because I don't know how to talk about my dad. My dad died when I was 15, and I haven't learned how to make everything right. And so, like, a lot of the times I'm like, oh, what do I do? Like, how do I make this like a funny joke? And so the joke I have about them that I'm scared to do, and the reason I put on my tombstone is because I'll be dead and my mom won't yell at me. So the joke is I was kind of raised in a Christian household, but my parents were in an interfaith. They were in an interfaith relationship because my mom was raised Baptist and my dad was not faithful. And so that's that's one of those jokes where like I would be happy to put that on my tombstone because that means I'm dead and my mom can't yell at me. And then there's one more. Oh, I have I just really, really like my black best friend face joke from Fallon where I say, I have what's known as black best friend face. Yeah. That's like
the color.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just like, yeah. It's such a fun joke and it's so just like light. I like right now, comedy can be light, but sometimes comedy is like super heavy. I was trying to tell someone a few weeks ago, I was like, man, I don't know if like my comedy is heavy enough sometimes for this era. Like sometimes people are like, you gotta get like mad. And I was like, but also some stuff is funny. We can't be light. Like, I'm not a comedian who's like, we need to storm the Bastille. Like, in the French, like, this is a joke I've been also working on where I'm like, during the French Revolution, like, I don't know, like, what I would have been as a comedian. Like, would I have been the comedian who's like, oh, man, we need to sharpen these jokes and the guillotines. This is like, like, have you heard about Marie Antoinette? Apparently she gives terrible head. Like, I don't know if that's me. I'm political in just, like, my being. But I don't want to get preachy. So it'd be like a light joke. That would, but, yeah, it'd be like a lighter joke.
That's... Thank you for sharing. And we got an exclusive on the show.
Your mom.
It's nowhere. That joke is nowhere. Well, because Drew and Brian, there's stuff that happens to you as a comedian. And like people are like, oh, man, yeah, but you can't wait to use this. But I'm like, nah. I'm like, my dad died and I don't know how to make that all the way funny. So I can wait.
I've got so much of that stuff floating around. I mean, my dad's still alive, but I've got all other things floating around in my head. Like, I know these can be made funny somehow. And Eventually you'll cross the analogy that just like, oh, that's the thing. Right. So we always got our antennas up for that type of, that's just who we are as humorists, I think. Yeah. I'm going to pop your website up, my
Sweet.
Man.
Man, thank you.
Want to share anything else to any place people can find you, anything you want to put up to our people.
You guys did an amazing job. J. Jordan Y'all is available on all streaming platforms. It's a fun 48-minute, 15-track album. And you can follow me, reach out to me on Twitter and Instagram. I respond pretty quickly to things. I'm on Cameo too, but no, just support artists, support comedians, watch Zoom shows, be a good Zoom audience member, turn your microphone on and laugh, turn your TV down in the back. I don't know. This is such a cool concept for a podcast. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, Jay, thanks for doing it. This has been a lot of fun. You're obviously a fan of comedy and so many great things that we can take away from us. Thanks again.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for your time, man.
And we're out of here. I've been Brian Gendron, Drew Jordan, breaking down bits.
Thanks for listening to Breaking Down Bits. You can keep in touch or get more when you follow at Breaking Down Bits on social media, visit the website breakingdownbits.com, or shoot us an email at breakingdownbits@gmail.com.